I've got some great news for you. I'm going to be offering my Artist Low Comedy Summer Weekend Intensives online, July 18th and 19th, and the weekend of August 1st through 2nd. If you're a seasoned improviser and you want a new approach to your improv, or you're a short-form player who goes, oh, I've never done long-form, well, this workshop's for you. And I'm going to tell you something. Some of my best students turn out to be short-form players. They're very committed. They're great actors. And they bring that short-form sensibility to the long-form work. In this workshop, you'll learn to slow down and take that pressure off yourself to try to be fast and funny. And guess what? The funny will come to you. But more importantly, when you start to slow down, you tap into a deeper emotional level. And guess what? Your unique life experiences come out of you automatically. And that's what it means by finding your voice in improv, giving yourself the permission and the freedom to just be yourself up there. If you're interested in working this way, I'll be offering the Artist Low Comedy Summer Weekend Intensives online the weekend of July 18th and 19th and the weekend of August 1st through the 2nd. For more information or to register, go to my website at jimmycorain.com. That's jimmycorain.com.
Jimmy Corain's a nerd. Jimmy Corain's an improv nerd. Jimmy Corain's a nerd.
Hi, this is Jimmy Corain, host of Improv Nerd, and you're listening to episode 266. Our guest today is Steven Castillo. At 19 years old, he started out doing stand-up comedy before moving to Chicago for 4 years to study improv. He is now a writer for Saturday Night Live, finishing up his third season. We talked to Steven about how improv helped him become a better stand-up, what his SNL audition was like, and we talked to him about some of his favorite sketches that he's created on the show. Before we get to the interview with Steven, I just want to say, because I haven't spoke about this since I've come back after. So this is like the sixth episode since I've returned. And I just want to say, the reason that I wasn't doing new episodes, one is I was really burnt out. And I felt like every interview, I was just asking the same questions over and over again. And the other thing is I was working on my one-man show, and the thing about me is I don't know how to multitask. So I couldn't put out new episodes and work on a one-man show at the same time. I wish it was different. I know my wife, Lauren, wishes I was different, but that's who I am. And I'm very grateful that during COVID-19, that I have an outlet, a creative outlet, so I can express myself and do these interviews and get these episodes out to you. So enough about me. You're really going to enjoy this episode, especially if you want to write for Saturday Night Live or a late night show. We really go backstage with Steven, and he gives us some really nice stories and some practical advice. So here it is, the Steven Castillo episode. Enjoy.
Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd, oh yeah. Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd.
Steven Castillo, thank you for being my guest on Improv Nerd.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Let's talk about you're 19 years old and you're doing stand-up in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. And then now you're going to Tulsa University, and Second City comes, the touring company, and they do a workshop. What happens when you take that workshop that you decide, oh, I'm going to move to Chicago and immerse myself in improv for the next 4 years?
Well, I obviously found this bug of doing comedy. My first open mic doing stand-up was almost like a dare to myself. And something happened that night where I still think that my first night doing stand-up was the funniest I ever was. Like, I'm trying to chase that high for the last 10 years. And I wanted to keep getting better and growing. And then when the Second Sitting Touring Company came and taught a workshop at my school, I didn't know that there was a whole city that was dedicated in comedy. Like, I was like, oh, that's where I need to go. And then obviously I saw the alumni and people that started there and did start. I read I think there was like an oral history on Second City, and started doing all that research. And I was like, okay, cool. Well, and then I found out that they were doing the summer classes, and I was like, yeah, I'm going there. You know what I mean? But it was like these guys introduced me to that world. And, you know, that was, that first summer was, you know, for 2 weeks, just doing improv classes there was, it just, I knew I was funny in Tulsa, but I wasn't sure if being funny in Tulsa meant anything, you know? So like the moment I could like make like my teachers in those classes laugh, or other kids in my class, gave me the confidence to be like, all right, well, maybe I'm not crazy. You know, maybe there's the world where this could be a big part of my life.
And so then you decide to move to Chicago, and then you finish the IO program, and you auditioned to get on Harold Teens, I would imagine, and you didn't get on, right?
Yeah, no, I failed miserably. I'm like a classic example of like, you could be bad at improv and still kind of like make it, you know?
You and I both.
Right.
If you're lucky, you end up doing a podcast for 8 years on improv.
You figured out the pivot.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and I think my biggest problem with improv is, I mean, there'll be weeks in the classes where I was the funniest person in the class. I'd steal the show, but I wasn't necessarily doing good improv. You know, I would go into it with a plan. I'd go into it, you know, putting my own thing in there without being free and letting stuff kind of happen. And there was weeks where I could get away with that. And then there was also weeks where I just kind of failed miserably. And I think, you know, I put so much pressure on myself to get on a Harold and to do well in these 5B shows that it was kind of like self-destruction a little bit, you know? I was so mad at myself and disappointed because so many of my friends who started with me got on and I didn't, and I was like, you know, it was tough, but you know, at the same time I was doing stand up, you know, it was like 50-50, you know, stand up and improv, and you know, it got to a point where I just felt like I had to pick between one or the other. And it seemed like stand-up was, you know, I learned a lot about myself doing improv. And one of the things I learned is that I'm a control freak. It's like, I need to go into something with a plan because I want to kill every time. So I want to do it on my own terms. And I wasn't able to let myself loose and go and just kind of be playful in that moment. However, improv made me a better stand-up, you know, because, you know, with improv is I could be free to do whatever the hell I want to and not seem weird. And stand-up, you know, it's very structured in terms of how you're supposed to do it. Well, I took the structure out of it because of improv and was doing more character-y bits that were more acceptable when I do at IO that I seem like a madman when I do them at the Laugh Factory, you know.
Your style is very absurdist and it's silly and it's also smart. How much did improv help you find that particular voice? Because when you came to Chicago, were you that absurdist, silly, smart?
No, I mean, when I started stand-up, I thought I wanted to be Seinfeld. I was wearing like suits to open mics and trying to do like observation stuff. And, you know, I think the first show that I saw when I moved to Chicago was like the Holy Fuck Comedy Hour, the Annoyance. And that was when I saw like John Reynolds, Gary Richardson, Carmen Christopher, a lot of people. And they were crazy absurd and they were unafraid to do whatever on stage. And that kind of like inspired me to be like, you know, they're doing this on the improv stage. What if I was able to do that on the stand-up stage? And it was really eye-opening.
And so here you are, you did a couple of years, you did some indie teams in Chicago. You're doing the indie stand-up scene here in Chicago. How does Saturday Night Live even know you're on the radar?
They didn't. I was in Chicago for 4 years. My my girlfriend at the time wanted to move to Los Angeles, and I was like, okay, I had some connections there. So I was like, I think it's time to make the move. I felt like I did as much as I could in Chicago, and I wanted to take it to the next step. And two nights before I left, but my second to last night in Chicago, I did the audition show for Just for Laughs at the Lincoln Lodge at the bar in Wicker Park at Subterranean. I don't know if that still exists. And I did like my second to last show there. And then I was living in LA, making like $8 an hour, struggling, starting over. Because when you move to a new city, you have to like basically start over and make new connections. And 3 months into it, I got a call from JFL saying that I'm going to be one of the new faces. And that was 2017, I believe. And I got my passport the day before I'm supposed to go to Montreal. That was the most stressful thing. I mean, if I hadn't got my passport, my whole life would be different. But through some glitch in the website, anyway, so I got it. I never even thought that SNL would even be at the show. I knew industry would be there. And at that time I had no agent or a manager. That's all I wanted, you know?
You wanted an agent, a manager, or SNL? What is it that you wanted?
I'll be honest with you. When I moved to Chicago, like SNL was definitely like on my mind. But then by the time I had my first year into Chicago, I snuck my name into the audition at IO. Like I wasn't supposed to audition like back in 2014.
How did you sneak your name to the audition?
I went into the green room and wrote my name on the thing. I don't know what led me to do that, but I just wrote my name in there and had a whole bit. And I remember I went up last and nobody knew who I was. And I did this whole bit where I basically took off almost all of my clothes and I'm like dancing in my underwear, and Sharna came up to me and I thought she was gonna like yell at me, and she was like said all these nice things, but she didn't know who the hell I was. And I was like, great. And I made it to the next round I think I was like in level 2 or 3 at IO, and I felt like a rock star. And then the week before the SNL auditions, I got cut. No one told me, but it was a huge relief because I wasn't ready. But yeah, it was definitely on my mind. And then as time went on in Chicago, I just figured I was too weird for SNL. I was more of an Adult Swim boy at that point. So I was like, screw it. And then when I finally got my manager and agent, they told me that we want to put you in front of SNL. And I'm like, really? That's bull. You're not going to like, that's, or yeah, I bet you say it to every new client. And then, yeah, they set up the audition. I did the old UCB.
In New York.
Yeah. And I did my set there. Was not the funniest one there. There was people there that were way better than me. I also know that it was a lot of UCB regulars, so I'm sure they had a lot of their crowd there like rooting for them. That night I found out that I'm screen testing and I'm gonna go and do it in front of Lorne and all the producers. I remember getting on the elevator and the doors opening. And it felt like it was like everything was in slow motion. It felt like I entered the Polar Express. Like I've only seen this in pictures, you know? And as the elevator doors open, there's the hallway across 8H on the stage. And I could see the stage from the elevator. It was a crazy experience. And I remember hearing all the stories about how you never hear laughs in the audition. So there was something that was like liberating in that. So it's just like, oh, I'm just going to pretend like I'm performing for myself, basically. And I remember my first bit, I was basically doing my stand-up JFL audition. And in my in my JFL set, I make fun of SNL. I do this bit where you hear like the intro. I say, and live from New York, it's Saturday night. And you would hear like, tear 'em, kill 'em, Bobby Moynihan. And I would pretend to like reenact the intro where everyone's smiling. And then it'd be, and featuring Stephen Castillo. And then it's just like me masturbating and I'm looking at Lauren. And like, I remember Mikey Day, like he stayed and watched my audition because he knew I was going to do that. And he wanted to see how they reacted. And I like didn't care because I'm like, I'm not getting hired. They're not going to hire me. I'm too weird for the show. So I was like, I might as well just do something weird so then I could share it on Improv Nerd or on WTF one day. Then the week after that, they asked me to screen test again. And that was weird because it was like seeing a lot of my old friends. Like that I hadn't seen in a long time. Like I saw Chris Redd was there, Gary Richardson, like just a bunch of people from Chicago that I hadn't seen in a while. Heidi Gardner, who I met at JFL. Yeah, I did another thing. I performed again and I basically tore off my tearaway pants and I did this whole, I got naked again. This time it was for Lauren instead of Sharna. I remember leaving the hallway in my underwear and then older man coming to shake my hand. And that man ended up being Lorne Michaels. So the first time I met Lorne, I was only wearing underwear on. Yeah.
You remember what he said to you?
Well, good job. And then I remember saying, thanks Lorne. Sorry. I'm going to put my pants back on. And then I could hear Colin laughing really loud. Because the whole situation was so weird, you know?
At that point, had you, I know for me, when I get a call back, I'm like, okay, now I have a chance. Did you have more expectations the second time audition than the first time where you're like, I'm not getting hired?
I think my first audition for Lorne, I remember feeling good about it, but I wasn't doing anything that SNL could put on the show. Like I was just doing my stand up. And I think I was like, I remember regretting be like, well, you know, I should have done more stuff pertaining to the show. Like I could do impressions. I could do, you know, character bits. And I didn't show that. I was just doing just my stand up. So if I had a second chance, I would show more of that stuff. And then I did get that second chance and I did it. And that second audition was like the best day of my life. Cause I could hear people laughing in the audition. And I was like, I remember leaving scared because it was like, this is crazy. It's mine to lose, you know, at this point, you know?
Were you scared that you were going to get it?
I was scared of getting disappointed.
Okay.
Yeah. I was scared of, because there was like, I'm pretty hard on myself, but at that moment I was like, it couldn't have gone better, you know? And if I don't get it after doing that, then it's like, I'm going to feel miserable. Like I'm not good at this at all, you know? And then the next day I'm in the waiting room with all my former Chicago. But the other thing too was, Before I knew I was going to meet with Lorne, you don't see anybody coming into the audition process. And all of a sudden I realized, oh my gosh, all these former people, all my friends from Chicago are in town right now. Like everybody, like all the funniest people in Chicago are there and everybody is saying how great their audition was. And I thought my audition was great. So I'm like, well, I'm screwed. I didn't get it. You know,
and I would have been the same way.
Yeah. I mean, there were guys who were just like talking to their managers and agents and like bragging kind of like how well they did. And I'm like, you know, and
comparison is a great thing, isn't it?
Yeah. But it's funny. The one person, and I feel comfortable saying this, the one person who felt like didn't do a good job, he was like, I screwed it up. I know I did, was Luke Knoll. You know, and he got it, you know? Yeah. So, it was a crazy, time, and then you know, meeting with Lauren, it's nerve-wracking because you're waiting for so many hours. And
did you know that? Because that's kind of that's kind of showbiz lore, that to meet with Lauren for the first time, you have to wait for hours and hours. Did you like show up with a book or
no? Okay. No. What I knew that I was expecting waiting for a while. What I didn't expect was I was going to be waiting with everybody else. And I was in a room with Bowen Yang. I was in a room with Sam Jay, Luke Knoll, Gary Richardson, Chris Redd, Andrew Dismukes. I was in a room with all these people who eventually were going to get hired in some capacity.
What do you talk about?
Well, see, that was what was so scary, because you know, there were people who were riffing and doing jokes and watching TV and pretending to be chill when we were all scared out of our minds, you know? And part of me was like, is this another audition? Is this a test? You know, like, am I supposed to be funny on the spot right now? I was like, I hate this. You know, I just, you know, it was that was the most stressful part, was waiting around. It wasn't the audition. And then you met with Lauren, and he was a super down to earth guy. And I felt like a guy I could have a conversation with about anything. You know, he was, you know, when we left, he got up and you know, my name in Chicago, my original name is Stephen King, and I had to change it to Stephen Castillo because JFL, that was a recommendation by JFL to make me change my name.
How'd you come up with Castillo?
Well, I got it. When you get JFL, you're not allowed to tell anybody that you got JFL, or else they'll take it away from you. So the only people I could talk to were the people running JFL. And so if
like
they
a government me, secret,
it's it like, was a government secret, right? So if they tell me I should change my name, I have to change my name.
And you can't tell anybody. You can't call your friends and say, this is what's going on.
You can't. So right. A lot of people can't tell from looking at me is that I'm Hispanic and that I lived in Mexico for like the first 5 years of my life. I'm fluent in Spanish, and like, that's like, you know, and my mom's maiden name is Hernandez Areola. So I wasn't going to be Steven Areola, Steve Nipple. I think
if you check, there's already somebody in SAG who is Steve.
right.
Areola.
Right. I'm not surprised. And there's definitely a Steve Hernandez in comedy. I was like, I wasn't going to screw that guy over. So gun to my head, I remember my mom, there was a soap opera actress named Kate Del Castillo. And I was like, oh, I like the sound of it. And I just picked it on the spot. It was like getting a tattoo drunk at 3 a.m. I had a chip on my shoulder being compared to some, I was the Michael Bolton syndrome in Office Space. You know, I had a chip on my shoulder being compared to this other guy.
Stephen King, the author.
No. The author, right. But I remember Lauren asking me if I wanted to change it back to Stephen King, or should I stick with Castillo, before offering me anything. And I was like, you have all the power. What name do you want? And he was like, no, that's not what I meant. Right. I was like, okay. So I was overanalyzing that question for weeks. Yeah. And then I got the call saying that Lauren wants me as a writer. And it was during my lunch break. I was working customer service in LA, and I just came back from lunch and I told my boss, I think I quit. I think I have to quit right now. Sorry. And I
wanted to ringing in the background.
You know? Yeah, exactly. Right. And, yeah, called my parents, and they were crying, and I was not emotional when I got it, because I had never written anything for anybody, and I knew how hard that job was going to be and how alien I was to it at the time. And I was scared. I was really, really scared and nervous that I was going to screw up, you know, that I wasn't going to last that long.
So what was it like when you walked in the first day? They're going to assign you a desk, and you know, as a writer, what's going on in your head? It's part of it. It's got to be surreal that you're working at a place that you always wanted to work at.
Yeah, it is surreal. The thing that always, and it still gives me goosebumps, is walking in the hallway on the 17th floor where all of our offices are, and you see the picture of everyone who's ever been on the cast. You see their pictures all lined up. And then it's like, at first it seems cool and nostalgic, but for me, it's like, it's haunting me. Like, you have to be as good as us if you're willing to stay here. It was super intimidating. And everybody there is super, super nice. And people will come out of their way to introduce themselves to you and say all these things. But once work starts, everybody closes their doors and they all have their writer, they have their group of people. And when work starts, you feel a little bit stranded a little bit. Like and that feeling is not exclusive to me. Everybody goes through that when they start, you know, they kind of have, you know, you start with all the new people and then eventually you start building relationships with other senior people and work stuff out. But the first week you're just like, what do I do? You know? Yeah. They throw you into the deep end.
When was it that a sketch got on that was like, okay, you could take a deep breath and go, now I'm contributing to the show?
I remember one thing that it got cut at dress, but it was
so for people that don't know, there's a dress rehearsal before,
right,
with the sketches, and some sketches don't make it to the live show that night.
Right, right. And I remember I decided to go out of my way and talk to a senior writer, because at that point I'd just been working with all the other new people, and be like, hey, I have some ideas if you want to work on something. And then I pitched him this idea about a guy arguing about the movie Shrek and being adamant that it's the best movie of all time. And he seemed to like that idea. We wrote it for James Franco, where he's meeting, you know, his girlfriend's parents for the first time. And they think Coco's the greatest animated movie of all time, and he thinks it's Shrek, and they almost get into a fight over it. And I remember at the table, Franco couldn't stop laughing because he had to tell Beck to
Beck Bennett, who's in this scene.
Yeah, he tells Beck to eat his ass, and we've never had that written into a sketch. So, and it was awesome. It really felt like, and also anybody that knows me for all my time in Chicago is that like referencing Shrek is like a big part of the reason I've been so successful in comedy for some reason. So it's like, when I knew that when my Chicago buddy saw a sketch about Shrek, they would know Steve wrote that. There's no other way. So that was cool. And then it got cut at dress, but then we brought it back for Sterling K. Brown. And what was cool was, like, the internet was very receptive towards it, because it was, you know, kind of this internet humor kind of now becoming a part of SNL, which I'm proud to, you know, say that I had a part in that.
Now, I read that when you were watching it, when it actually went to air, that you weren't sure that it was a good sketch. Is that right?
Yeah, I was dreading reading anything about it online. I was trying to avoid Twitter, and then eventually people on the online seemed to like it a lot, and it made me feel good. But you know, you watch this thing being rehearsed and played out so many times throughout the week that, like, you don't know what it is anymore. So you just see all the negatives instead of the positives, you know? like even today watching it, it's hard for me to watch because it's like, you know, I don't know. It's I just see it through different lenses. Yeah.
And then later with Elie Mandel and Alec Lenick, you write this Weezer sketch.
Yeah. Yeah,
which is similar in terms of it's an argument at a dinner table. And as I was watching it, I'm thinking, you know, what is going on in Steven? What happened in Steven's family growing up at the dinner table? Was there arguments like that?
I think like I think a big part of my comedy is like threatening people for things that I shouldn't threaten them over. You know, and just like taking things way too far. And so like, I definitely think that I talk that way with my brother and sister for sure. You know, Eli is a huge Weezer fan. Like he's like obsessed with them. And he came to me about doing a Weezer thing. And then I kind of figured, you know, well, we could have Matt Damon as this Weezer Uber fan. And then a producer had the idea of adding Leslie to it, and then it was like, well, I've seen Leslie like in sketches where she goes off on people, and the thought of like Leslie being like a Weezer purist made us laugh so hard because we knew Leslie didn't know who the hell Weezer was. Yeah. And it was so funny to just pitch that to her and she looking at us like we're fucking crazy. Yeah.
You also mentioned that your parents were very supportive of your career, which I don't have experience with that from my parents. How were they supportive of your career?
Yeah. I mean, my mom is a performer. She was like a former like ballerina in Mexico. She used to travel cross country and do these shows, and so a lot of the stuff that I have I got from her and yeah, so she was willing to let me go, and I think the biggest thing for my mom was she comes from a very traditional Mexican family, and she wasn't allowed to leave the house until she got married. Like her mom was very like sheltering, you know, like, and for my mom knew how much I loved Chicago. My mom knew how much I cared about this stuff. And I'm also her firstborn. And she has those Mexican like tendencies, like it comes from her roots, you know? So for her to be able to let me go, and I knew it was so hard for her, it was like, I think that's another reason why, for better or for worse, I'm so hard on myself. And like when I was in Chicago, I was like, I have to make this count. I have to make this worth it, because leaving home was like the hardest decision I've ever had to make. Because in my house and my family, like, you know, from generation and generation on, sometimes you don't leave the house till like you're in your late 20s or your 30s. Like when you know, people don't leave, you know? So I carry that. I still carry it. I still gotta be like, I gotta pay my mom back. I gotta do all this stuff for her, cause she gave me the opportunity to do all this stuff. And my dad, he's the proudest guy in the world. For better or for worse. I mean, he's my number one fan, and I know it must drive his friends crazy, because all he does is talk about me. And it drives me crazy too, but it could be a lot worse. So I'm grateful for that.
You know, you mentioned you're hard on yourself. I certainly can relate to it. And you're in a really, I think a very high pressure job at Saturday Night Live, very competitive in terms of, there's only 10% of the scenes, you know, you pitch 80 or 90, they're going to take 10%. How do you keep your confidence up when there's weeks where you're not going to get something on the show?
I don't. That's my answer. I would say I've been writing there for 3 years now, and you know, rejection doesn't get easier, but it gets familiar. So I've gone through the stuff before. I see the patterns. If this is going to be a bad week, then next week is going to be a good week. So just try not to make the bad week feel as bad. You just make it worse by putting yourself down, you know? Another thing is just like, I use it as a chip on my shoulder too. If something doesn't go well, and then the next week I just work my ass off to try to make up for it. You know, I have this unhealthy thing where I like to get myself into a hole just so I can like prove to myself that I can get out of it.
You also mentioned that Adam Sandler was a big influence on you, partially because you love his work, but also you love his work ethic.
Yeah, I just turned 30 and I want to be Adam Sandler when I grow up. Like, he is the greatest celebrity I've ever seen in person. You know, when he came and hosted, you know, he surrounds himself with people that he's comfortable with. He surrounds himself with his best friends, people who are funny. And I was like, oh my God, if I have the ability to do that one day, that's the best, because you get the most out of yourself when you're comfortable. It's just like, I'm the funniest when I'm around my brother and sister because they know me so well, you know? And, you know, seeing him work, seeing him, you know, also just be as generous as he is. You know, I got a chance to hang out with him when I was in LA. I was in a meeting for a company at, you know, pitching something. And then I get a text from Sandler saying, meet me in Santa Monica right now. And I left the meeting immediately. And I showed the people my phone. It's Sandler. I got to go. And I hung out with him when he was editing his movie.
Did he give you any advice? Did you ask him for any advice?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I did. And his advice was great. And I think without going too into it, I think basically, you know, all the feelings and that I have were things that he felt at a certain stage in his life, you know, which was nice to hear, you know. And it was, you know, the one thing about Sandler is he never looks back. He's always moving forward. As soon as he's done with a project, he starts immediately thinking about the next project. He starts immediately just work. And that was like, oh, that's how I need to be. I can't dwell on the sketch that didn't do as well as I wanted it to. I have to immediately start thinking about the next thing, you know? And that was the biggest takeaway that I got from him. And then also, the guy is one of the biggest celebrities in the world. He didn't have to be so generous to hang out with me and give me advice and all that stuff. And it reminded me, hey, I'm kind of now, I'm not an open micer anymore. He reminded me that I have to be generous as well. And help out friends and do things for other people, and kind of pay it forward.
This season, Saturday Night Live, they did their SNL at home shows.
Yeah.
And I'm curious about the process. Was it harder or easier because there were so many restrictions? Like, there's only so much you can do on Zoom. There's no sets. There's no costumes, there's no wig, there's no makeup. How was that? How did you come up with the ideas?
It was definitely harder, for sure. Because all of it is pre-tape, so obviously nothing is live. So when you're working on a pre-tape, you're in the editing room with the editor, splicing everything together. Well, now we can't do that. So now it's like the editor will show us a cut and then we have to email our notes. But sometimes our notes, they can't be articulated through email. So it's so much more back and forth, and there's, you know, breaks in communication that you lose when you're not, like, as opposed to being in person. So it was tough. And then also, you know, all the cast members were in charge of lighting, sound, you know, setting up a green screen, like all these things that they were never hired to do in the first place. You know, with the exception of like Chloe Fineman, who had been making videos before she got on SNL, and her apartment is practically a studio. You know, it's different. It was tougher for a lot of people. That being said, if you look at the stuff that we worked on, it's amazing that we did as much as we did with the fact that we were all staying at home. You know, I did an animated thing with Dan Bulla, and we were lucky that you know, made it on, but that was, you know, a crazy thing too, because animation apparently is not easy. It's actually like the hardest thing you could do, you know? And it's incredibly time consuming. But you know, we were able to pull it off, and I'm really proud of a lot of the things that we were able to do.
Yeah, I was too. I mean, I think it started a little rough the first show, but mm-hmm. then you guys really hit your stride, and it was so fun to watch, like how it evolved really quickly. Like some of the music stuff. There was one where Pete Davidson, mm-hmm. he did like a video in his apartment with all these lights and stuff. Do you remember this?
Yeah, I was
just like, whoa, this is really. And then I love the, there was a sketch with the grocery store with Kate and 80. And I was just like, this is really, I mean, they're really hitting it, you know?
Right. It took us a while at first it was like, can we do this? And then I think the first episode was like charming. The fact that we were able to pull anything off, and then people got excited, and then people started really putting a lot of work into the next batch of stuff. But we just had to get through the first one to see if it was even remotely possible, you know?
Now, and I don't know why I'm obsessed by this, but like if somebody needed a wig or a costume, did they get it mailed to them? How did they do that?
Yeah. There was, well, just to give you an example, we did a thing with Bowen where he played Kim Jong-un, and I remember that we had to get around things because it was like, well, certain costumes we can't mail because they're in 30 Rock and we're not allowed to get inside the building. So we would get around it some way. So what we ended up doing was like, the costume people just bought a Halloween costume on Amazon and just sent it to Bowen, you know? And we just like put a blanket under him to make him look like he had a bigger stomach.
Yeah, we've got to wrap this up. Stephen, I want to thank you for paying it forward to me and the people that are listening. And we end the podcast always with the same question, which is, what one piece of advice would you give somebody starting out in comedy or improv today?
You could be bad at improv and still do Improv Nerd with Jimmy Corain. Yeah.
Wow. Dude, I'm going to get flooded with emails, my friend. Thank you. You just set me up. All right. Stephen Castillo, thank you so much for being my guest on Improv Nerd.
Thank you so much, GB. I love this. This is great. Big fan of the show.
And there you have it. Another great episode of Improv Nerd is in the can. And I want to thank Stephen Castillo for being our guest. It means a lot to me that he took time out of his schedule and also that he's a fan of the show. I also want to thank my producer, Dan Schiffmacher. You wouldn't be hearing my voice if it wasn't for Dan. And Lauren Corain, who is the head of interns and also an associate producer and edits and organizes The Question. If you want more information about me, Jimmy Corain, and my award-winning Artist Low Comedy classes that are now online, go to my website, jimmycorain.com. That's jimmycorain.com. Follow us on Twitter at improv_nerd. Like our Improv Nerd Facebook page, because it really helps with my low self-esteem. And thank you for listening. And until next time, remember, walk, don't run.